Hello, it's AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 16, and it's April. You know what April is? Avengers Month. You know what Avengers is? Well, it's also a movie, but it's a comic, okay? And my name's David Brook, and I'm here with...
Hello, I'm Forrest with two R's, and I'm 76%
water. 76% water, wow. Do you have your Avengers tickets yet?
I do not. I should do that. Let me tell you about the local movie theater real quick as a start to this show.
Do it.
I got a soapbox at the top of the show.
Oh my God, he's got two, folks. He's got another one later.
We don't have a Regal. We don't have an AMC. Support your local businesses. That's fine. The movie theater in town does not take card.
Mm-hmm.
They take cash only.
Wow.
They have an ATM
in the lobby.
Oh,
those dicks.
Convenient.
Mm-hmm.
It has a $4 transaction fee. And I found out recently that the owner of the movie theater owns that ATM.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's like a scam.
It's a scam.
Is he also a gangster?
It is a scam. Yeah, he walks around going, "Hey, you guys buy your tickets here?" He's like a vaudeville. He's like a vaudeville villain.
Are you kidding? Are you serious?
I'm totally kidding.
Episode 16, guys. I hope you enjoy this show because we're about to dive into the news, how we start our show every single week, talking about the latest news that everyone's talking about on the internet, usually Twitter.
Usually almost exclusively Twitter.
It seems like the most active social media platform that these creators are using. I mean, a lot of the artists are using Instagram, but Twitter is like the newsifying of a lot of people's thoughts and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear about things on Twitter before anywhere else. I build the show notes every week, and most of the stuff, the news stack that we get is from Twitter, or at least I hear about it on Twitter first before I find details somewhere else.
Right.
I would say that if you guys want like a lead on news, or you want to find out a lot of stuff about the industry and about artists and writers' processes and stuff, Twitter is a really great place. Just don't ever look at the replies.
Yeah, there's a lot of hate.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, as earlier this week, you had shared with us on our website, Slack, about Jonathan Hickman saying he's not taking interviews and he gave his top five mutants. I instantly newsified that, and it got something like 4,000 views in a day.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think I beat Bleeding Cool by like 3 hours or something. And by I beat, I mean we beat. And by we beat, I mean that's what we do on this show. We're on a comic book beat. And the first bit of news this week that we're going to be talking about is how Marvel is teasing Acts of Evil. I put that in air quotes if you don't know. I'm doing it in real life. And it's coming out this July, the month right after War of the Realms ends, and the month right before that Carnage event kicks off.
Absolute Carnage.
Absolute Carnage. What's interesting is, first of all, Marvel has not released an official teaser or anything yet. But a bunch of the Marvel editors have shared on, what was it, Twitter?
Oh, Twitter.
An image that is very familiar and reminiscent of an older event called Acts of Vengeance, which was a
1989 to 1990 series where Loki brought together a bunch of villains to destroy the Avengers, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man. The first appearance of the Tri-Sentinel, actually.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting thing to be following up War of the Realms with. After this giant war, are the villains going to maybe, this is my theory, the villains have seen that the heroes are weak and they can strike, right? So they band together and do some evil doing.
Here's my theory.
Ooh, I want to hear.
It's Marvel's perfect response to DC's "You're the Villain."
It really could have been like
how
a last,
convenient.
It could be like a last minute thing where they were like, "Hey, why don't we do our own?"
Yeah, well, it's a villain event. I'm pretty excited about it. I think that it'll be relatively low stakes.
Mm-hmm.
It may be kind of the villains taking advantage of the spoils of war type thing left over for more of the realms. But I don't think it'll be all that serious. I think it'll be pretty fun. There will probably be some giant, ridiculous denouement the same way there is in Acts of Vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man has the power cosmic at the end of that event also. So,
which was awesome.
I don't know. Yeah, absolutely. Totally awesome.
I mean, it's unclear if this is going to be just a month event or if it will carry on into the fall. But I will say this. I'm kind of thinking that people are going to have some event fatigue by the time this comes out, because War of the Realms is like 100 and something issues.
Marvel started the top of this year by saying that they weren't going to do as many events.
Yep.
And now they've got them kind of back to back to back to back. It's got to make those writers' retreats frustrating for the creatives, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be difficult. You have to like always be thinking about this other thing that's affecting your character.
Yeah, and not to pit people against each other, and we talked about this a bit in our Christopher Sabella interview, but it kind of creates a favorite in the classroom where someone has pitched an idea for an event, Absolute Carnage, Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman, or War of the Realms, Jason Aaron, and whoever is heading up this Acts of Evil event, where everyone else is beholden to that idea as soon as that's the idea that CBD Cebulski or Nick Lowe or any of the other editors say that they like. Everyone's just contributing to that idea, or the editors are saying, you can use whatever characters you want, but your narrative needs to feed into this story. You know, and I think Marvel's pretty good about giving creators a certain degree of latitude. And you can see on our X-Men Monday column every week over at AIPTComics.com where Jordan White consistently says, the stories are the artists and creator and the writers' own, and we want them to use the characters that they want to use, but it has to fit a specific trend for Marvel, basically. It seems like when you do War of the Realms, Acts of Evil, and then Absolute Carnage, it's more trend than not. And that's difficult.
Yeah, it's funny. Scott Snyder, on our 11th episode when we interviewed him, he talked a little bit about doing these events and how the way he framed it was you kind of give every single book, so every other creative team, an in and an out, where the character needs to be at the beginning and then the end. But he also said they don't have to do that. They can do whatever they want if they don't want to do it. Although, of course, I'm sure there's pressure from other angles, like editors or whatever, going, no, we have to do this because we need to get the sales up a little bit if it's not a War of the Realms tie-in or whatever. But he made it sound a little less forced on people. But I don't know. I really don't know how the ins and outs of go like this. I would love to go to one of those Marvel writer retreats and like figure out like what the dynamic is, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, me too.
You know, a series that's never had an event from Image Comics called, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called The Walking Dead. It's a zombie comic.
Tell me more.
It's about a guy named Robert Kirkman. I don't know if you've ever heard of him either. No, obviously one of the most famous comic series turned TV shows ever. Well, in the news, Robert Kirkman said that there's a lack of walkers for a reason.
Yeah, as of issue 190.
Why is that, I wonder?
Well, a fan wrote in to the column and basically, in the most non-accusatory way that a person could say this, said, this comic's not really about zombies anymore, huh?
Yep.
And Kirkman was like, it isn't. You know, I think that we've had some really interesting events lately that have happened because the walkers are pushing characters into certain corners, but I can't deny that the walkers don't excite me or move the narrative in the same way that they used to. Okay. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with that. You're at almost 200 issues. I expect a narrative to change.
You know what's fascinating about this from my perspective? I started reading Walking Dead when it came out. It was sold as, what if a horror movie, those horror movies you love, horror zombie movies specifically, all these horror movies, they come out and they're only an hour and a half, right? They're only 2 hours and then it's over. What if we did that with a comic, but it wasn't just 2 hours? It was, you know, if you were to convert it into a film, hundreds of hours, being hundreds of comic book issues, right? And the concept was like, wow. So what happens when you take this horror trope, this horror premise, and just keep going forward? Like what? And so with that conceit, obviously it's about the people, right? It's about how they act and change over time. But to remove the zombies, he's not actually removing the zombies, but he's limiting them. It seems like, I don't know. It seems to me like you're getting away from the whole point of doing it. Because it's about the relationship between humans and whatever monster is out there. At least that's how they pitched it originally. Now, I mean, like you said, though, it's been going on for so long. Of course, you know, his mood and his, you know, his feelings about his project are going to change.
Yeah, I think the idea of something that was previously such a direct and acute threat becoming more akin to like a natural disaster.
Yeah.
where it happens every once in a while and you're aware of it and you have to build certain precautions. That is interesting to me. And I understand that that's maybe not the reason that people bought into a comic called The Walking Dead.
Right. Although one could say that he also meant the people are walking dead, right?
Sure. Absolutely. And I think the characters are more important than the zombies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the book is about how humans change to this, as you say, natural disaster.
Right. It's about how does a person change when they realize that that horror doesn't click off at the end of the 2-hour movie, right? When it's there every day. Just as you're saying, you get used to it.
Right.
It's more optimistic than a lot of people think, and certainly than the show often presents, mm-hmm. too, in that people are highly adaptive.
You know, not to mention, over time, shouldn't the zombies, like, not even be able to stand because it was so rotten?
Like, yeah, they're not walkers anymore.
Right, like...
The crawling dead.
I don't actually read the series anymore, but how much time has passed? Like, it's been a couple years now, right?
Oh, it's been, like, a decade or more.
Now, obviously, a zombie can be like magic and just forever not decay, but we've seen them decay in the comics. So at this point, they should all be mush.
Yeah. The mushy dead.
The mushy dead. Oh, that's
they should. That's what they should do. Yes. As much as the narrative is a moving target, they should be changing the title with it.
That's interesting.
The No More Dead.
You know what's funny is DC Young Animal, you know, it stopped. And we all thought, oh, it must not have been making DC very much money. But apparently it's back this July and we'll be making them money again.
Yeah.
Gerard Way and others are coming back with 3 series: Collapser, Far Sector.
Got a black hole in him.
Yeah, yeah. Which they started debuting the art on that with the black hole when the actual black hole image came out, which was very well timed.
That's awesome. Timely. Yeah.
And the other series being Doom Patrol, Weight of the Worlds. Forrest, do you ever feel like the world is weighing you down?
Yeah, my back hurts.
Yeah. Get that back brace, man.
I'm actually, as we're recording right now, I bumped this desk that I record at to the standing position. Got one of those sit standies. I'm doing this standing.
Your voice is so much richer.
Oh, thank
I feel
you.
Closer
the
to
dulcet,
you.
The dulcet tones.
Dolby Digital, 7.1 right now, coming out of your voice.
It's got me the confidence that I would need to, one, write something like Young Animal. No, I'm nowhere near as good as them. Or two, understand half of the things that the writers put into comics that come from the Young Animal line.
He's being modest, folks. He's a great writer, and he knows his stuff.
I'm excited to read our reviewer Ritesh Babu's reviews of these.
You think he's going to do them? Did he express interest?
I would hope so. Mm. Yeah, I would hope that some folks smarter than me take a whack at these.
In the afterword, in the volume, the first volume of Doom Patrol that they released, Gerard Way specifically referenced one of his reviews.
Really?
Yes, because Helen, and we call him Helen because we have a couple Pats at the site, but Helen Patrick, yeah. In one of his reviews basically explained, I'm going to totally mix it up because this was like 8 months ago now. He basically described the book in the way that it's confusing, but in a good way. Like, it's confusing, but that makes sense for this book. And Way was like, this perfectly exemplifies what I was going for, which aligns with what you were just saying. Like, this...
That it sure does.
That series... Yeah. A lot of these... I mean, a lot of the DC Young Animal books were like this, too, but that series in particular was tricky to sort of follow along with, which made it kind of fun and interesting.
I'm going to probably miss a couple of here, but the original Young Animal line was Doom Patrol, Gerard Way's Doom Patrol, mm-hmm. Milk Wars.
Wait, don't forget Nick Darrington as well. He was on Doom Patrol.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course.
Milk Wars was like an event, too.
Eternity Girl.
Yeah.
The Bug.
Oh, yes.
And Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye.
Yep, and one more. Shade the Changing Girl.
Shade the Changing Girl, and then Shade the Changing Woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The sequel.
Yes.
Yeah.
All equally fantastic.
Yes. Yes.
For different reasons. All equally reverent to different DC lineages, I guess might be the word that I would want to use for that. Different tropes and characters and very specific runs. Except for maybe Eternity Girl, which is reverent to kind of the whole idea of a comics continuity. Obviously, Doom Patrol owes a lot to Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bug and a bunch of other stuff are just direct continuations of prior DC stories. But I loved them all so, so much. I didn't necessarily understand them, at least on the first read.
Yeah.
They're philosophically and narratively and even artistically very dense.
Right.
But in the same way that some of like Tom King's stuff is, or the same way that modern Morrison is, even the same way that some Warren Ellis is, or even Hickman, where you're like, this is a lot of idea,
mm-hmm.
maybe not a lot of meat, or a lot of line to line stuff for me to grab onto.
Mm-hmm.
But on a second read, or when you go to Wikipedia and you read about the things that they're referencing, it's so rich and so worthwhile and so contextualized and put into this great broader comics history that I like very much.
I reviewed most of Cave Carson, and Michael Avon Oeming's so good. I mean, his style really worked well with it. And not to mention Nick Filardi's colors. I don't know if he's won an Eisner yet, but he should win them all after that series, in my opinion. but that book was so trippy. It just fit in like with that trippiness. The narrative was a little simpler because it was basically like, at least the first arc was about the main hero kind of saving his daughter from this like underground realm.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was also written by John Rivera with Gerard Way. And but what was cool about that one in particular for me anyway, because I read most of these series, was how it kind of integrated into the main universe. Like Superman was in the book, in one of the books.
Yeah, right. And that's what I mean, is that they feel like children of the DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the fact that they are for children.
No.
But that they feel like the next, like protege comics.
One of the Cave Carson's issues, there was like a giant naked woman and they were like looking at a vagina or something. I forget. Yeah, it was intense.
Weird.
It was intense. You know, another book where you get to see a close-up of vaginas?
Oh, what a transition.
Saga is the next piece of news we've got here today. Actually, on Friday, Brian K. Vaughan was talking to EW Entertainment Weekly, and he told them that the last Saga issue will be number 108, which is interestingly timed because the last issue released back in July of 2018 was issue 54. So we are dead smack in the middle of this series.
Yep.
And one other thing to note is it took 7 years to get to 54 issues, which is a little longer than most because they go on hiatus, and they take
pretty lengthy hiatuses.
And they also don't double ship like a lot of these other books that are coming out. But that's a good thing. It makes it more episodic. It makes it so you can kind of, like a great TV show, like Lost, that many people hate, but I loved, where you get to think about it and talk about it for a month and then go on hiatus and talk about it even more. It's a sad thing to know that it's ending, but I think we all kind of knew that was coming, right?
I would want it to have a finite end.
Yeah.
Rather than just kind of continuing.
Hazel's been slowly growing up. I mean, obviously, that makes it even more finite. I mean, if this was like a ongoing big two book, I'm sure Hazel would still be a baby at 54 issues.
Yeah, right. I mean, she's like a toddler now. She's like a young kid now.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Who knows, when we get to issue 55, maybe she'll be like 18 or something.
And certainly by the end of 108, I could see her time jumps and stuff like that being as old as Alana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it feels right.
Yes, it does.
It's going to make me cry and I'm going to hate it. It's like when you get to the end of a good book and you're like mad at the writer for doing that to you.
Well, yeah. 54 especially was, I'm not going to spoil it, but man,
yeah,
that is brutal.
Absolutely.
Brutal, brutal, brutal.
But you're just kind of like, there's not more.
Right. Yeah. We're in the society where we binge.
What?
Binge.
Were you out of ideas?
Get back to work. You know who...
I don't care if you don't like zombies anymore. Write them.
You know who is getting back to work because he's so successful and probably one of the biggest X-Men creators of all time based on sales alone is the creator of Major X, which has now sold out and gone to a second print twice for issue number one and number two. Before it even came out, folks, people are buying this so much. But even then, even though they are going to second printing, these books are selling like hotcakes on eBay. I'm sorry, I didn't say. Rob Liefeld is the creator I was mentioning before.
We could talk around his name.
A bit sarcastically, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, it's all right.
So I don't have much to say about
this. He's pretty good at crediting himself anyway.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I saw...
this is nostalgia.
The first issue of Major X has been listed upwards of $100 on eBay.
Wow.
Folks, both Dave and I have read Major X.
We did.
Don't pay $100 for that
Please
comic.
Please don't.
Don't pay $100 for many comics.
Don't pay $10,000 for Avengers tickets either.
Don't... Yeah. Don't... No matter what percentage of water is in the movie...
True.
And no matter what percentage of Deadpool is or is not in the comic, don't pay that amount of money for that.
Yeah.
It's just ink on paper.
You know, it is $3.99 digitally all the time.
Forever.
Yes.
But if you do pay $100 for a comic,
mm-hmm.
know that you can get it signed by Rob Liefeld.
Ooh, how much is that? Cheap, right?
Not cheap.
Oh.
let's see. For $100.
Oh, that's it?
Yes. So $200 total for the Major X number one.
Will he also talk to you for a minute, or does he just, like, get out of the line?
You could get a photo with him for another $40.
With your own cell phone, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I was reading X-Men Monday last week, which posts every Monday, where the editor of X-Men Comics, Jordan White, answers our questions at AIPT exclusively, that he thinks that Cyclops and Jean are no longer married, even though they're both now alive, because they both recently came back to life in the last year. They are that marriage annulled or something.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
the way he sets it up, it was like Cyclops is almost like a clone. Like when he was reborn, he's no longer the Cyclops that that she married, right?
Yeah, it's like... He died and came back, so he's alternate reality Cyclops. And also, he brings up the point that they've died and come back before.
That's true.
Or at least Jean has. I don't know.
To death do us part, right? To death do us part.
I don't want to get into the ethics of cloning. till clone do us part is much more complicated, and maybe that's why we don't say that. The legal ramifications are kind of interesting, which is till death do us part, and that's why our ex-editor Chris Hassan asked the question.
Right.
I'm down with
Look,
that.
Look, story-wise, I'm happy about this because now we don't have to worry yeah. about like, oh, Cyclops wants to be with Jean. Like, we can have new relationships form without that pressure, you know?
The bigger question for me is the correct word annulled, divorced, or dissolved?
You know what's interesting watching people on Twitter react to this was like, this doesn't happen in real life. People don't die for like a year or two or 10 and then come back to life.
Yeah. So maybe there is no.
Right. Yeah. Right. Like there was a lawyer who came out and was like, actually, I know the answer to this because I'm a lawyer. It's like, do you? How many clients do you have died?
No, you fucking don't.
And I'm not talking someone who like died for like 2 minutes on the table and then was brought back. Like that's different. That's also.
Oh my God. That's such a bonkers way to get out of a marriage though.
Yeah, that's right.
That's fucking awesome.
Why did you put the fork in the wall? Well, I just hate my wife.
Well.
Okay, guys. That was the news. That was the news. We're done with news now. We're moving on. Get over it. Because now we're going to be talking about comic books that are really, really good. And this is, yeah, you're going to like to talk about or listen to this part of the show because we give our top two picks of last week. And we also bring up top two picks from comicbookroundup.com. Critic top pick. This is new, guys. And fan top pick. Isn't that exciting?
I'm standing. I have been standing the whole time, but I'm more standing.
Can I get an update
now.
On that standing? How is your
Still
right
standing.
Foot? How does it feel? Is it sore yet?
My right foot feels good. My lower back feels a little tense.
Have you done the wave yet?
I have not done the wave yet. A one-person wave?
Use your imagination.
I'll do it, but I think it might look like I'm doing a standing worm.
Okay. I'm going to imagine it for the rest of the show. You're going to just constantly be doing the wave. So the top critic rated comic book with a 9.7 was Murder Falcon from Image Comics. And the top fan pick with a 9.2 was Dead Man Logan number 6.
Yes.
Interesting top picks. They're very different from each other.
Yeah, they are entirely different from each other. Dead Man Logan number 6, I think, is largely in part due to how fervorous X fans are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a negative way at all. X fans are absolutely some of the best at supporting their books.
Hungry.
I think that Marvel has such a wide X line, because X fans support their books. And you can have such a wide, even individual Wolverine line because Wolverine fans support their books as like a subgroup of X fans. So that totally makes sense to me.
And that book has two Wolverines in it.
Double your money. There you go. In Wolverine bucks. And then Murder Falcon number 7 as a critical darling also makes sense to me, mm-hmm. because that is a really fantastic creator-owned standout, really.
Visually arresting is what I call
it. Yeah, absolutely. And so those both make a lot of sense to me. I can see the fan favoritism for Dead Man Logan, and I can see the critic favoritism for Murder Falcon, because it's metal as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And all critics like metal across the board.
And it has two Wolverines fighting in a bar. I mean, come on. What else could you ask for out of a comic book? Well, you could ask for a lot more, because we're about to talk about our picks. Forrest, what is your second favorite book of last week?
My second favorite pick is Star Wars Age of Rebellion, Princess Leia. Ooh. So, this is a one-shot Princess Leia story written by Greg Pak with art by Chris Sprouse. It's set between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. That was kind of like the reason that I latched onto it right away, because I've seen very few comic books, especially new canon Marvel comic books, told in that timeline or in that segment there. And also, I don't know that there's that many in the quote-unquote Legends category either, certainly not comics, maybe novels.
Yeah, there was a Shadow of the Empire, I believe, which was between those.
Yeah, but not as many. And this is a really cool one that is a perfect example of how to contribute something to the world or something to a specific character.
Well said.
Without telling too much or taking away from something that exists. I think that there's a way to do that to enrich your enjoyment of something without being like, well, that doesn't really add up, or that doesn't make sense, or this is more about this now when I see it in the movie. This is just kind of a wink to Princess Leia and kind of a nice connection between those two movies.
What was the title of it? It was about, was it Scoundrel Princess, I think?
Yeah.
Sorry mm-hmm. for interrupting.
No problem. I should have said that. And it's the story of how Leia gets the Boosh costume. The
my
Bounder
God,
Boosh.
It's pronounced Boosh?
I have no idea.
Oh, sorry.
Nobody has ever heard these things said out loud.
Right.
Bosch, Boosh, either way. And then how she gets Chewie to take him to Jabba's palace to free Han from Carbonite. I did a lot of weird slam poetry pausing there. I sounded unconfident, but this comic is very confident in its delivery. It's a really cool kind of like bounty hunter versus bounty hunter story, and it's a little bit about can Leia stand up against hardened criminals in the Star Wars universe. I mean, Bosk and a couple of other bounty hunters from his crew are not people to mess with. I was looking at some Star Wars trivia right after this, and Bosk is like the number two badass in the universe after Boba Fett. Bosk's name means to devour his prey.
How does he do with that in this issue, though?
and so there's some cool back and forth. You know, they're fighting about Lando in particular.
Ooh, spoilers.
Her and Bosk.
Spoilers.
You're doing this really weird soundboard bit. We got to get some of those recorded. that I liked a lot. I thought it was really well done. It showed this good rebellious streak, this really good strong streak that Leia has that isn't explored as much in the movies. That kind of you see a little bit at the Return of the Jedi, but you don't really know where that came from necessarily.
Right.
This comic does a great job of explaining why.
I reviewed this one for aptcomics.com, and one of my main, sort of mimicking what you just said, one of my main pros was like, when we see her in New Hope, she's got her own edge, but she's still sort of a princess, right? And in this, we see she's a bit more of a pirate. She's grown up a little bit and grown into this new sort of role, and she's taking it head on, and she's really good at it.
Yeah.
There's a show I used to watch called The Mighty Boosh, which made me think of that when you said Boosh.
Old Man Greg.
What's that, Old Man Greg?
That's a bit from The Mighty
Boosh. Oh, you watched that?
Old Swamp Greg.
I haven't seen it in so long, I don't even know what you're talking about, but I remember laughing a lot about that show.
One of the guys from The Mighty Boosh is a host on The Great British Bake Off now.
Oh, interesting. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yes. Look at that. Side convo right there about a obscure British show from 2013. 2013 is when it ended. Anyway,
what was your number two pick?
It was a book from Boom Studios, which we don't usually bring up, not because they don't make good comics, just because this one has an edge. It's called Faithless Number One, by Brian Azzarello and art by Maria Lovett. And she comes from an indie background with a book where there's like dominatrix characters and a lot of sexuality. So it makes sense that she'd be doing this because Boom Studios is really selling the sexual angle on Faithless. They're calling it an erotic comic. So when I open the book up, I'm like, all right, we're going to get some French erotic comics right here. You know, like if you've ever read erotic comics, the French know what they're doing. And instead, sort of a mild masturbation scene to open the book and some sex at the end. I brought this up to my girlfriend. I'm like, look how not sexy this is. And she's like, that's pretty graphic. I'm like, I don't know. But that's neither here nor there. The reason it's on my list is because I think the character writing is really good. And I brought this up last week, too, because it was my most anticipated book. At the time when I said that, I had already read it. Spoilers. I already knew it was pretty good. I think the character building is really, really good. Most of it is about this girl named Faith meeting another girl who just broke up with her boyfriend. And they spend the day together. And I think that there's a lot of subtle character building going on here. And when you can pull off subtle anything in a comic book story, given that most comic books are only 20 pages, you're doing a really good job. That's hard to do. Most comic books, especially, 10 years ago, they were telling 6-issue arcs and like it was literally like 5 hours of time in real time in the story. This feels like it's only one day, but it feels like it's doing so much to give us detail about these people. And it ends with an insane cliffhanger where you're like, yuck, and where's this going? So I'm game for issue number two.
Yeah, I liked it too. It was nowhere near as edgy as I kind of expected. Yeah. The marketing implied that it would be, I guess. Yeah. Especially given that Brian Azzarello is writing it. I don't think that the marketing did any favors for it coming out of Batman Damned and stuff like that. But I thought it was cool and I'm excited to see where it's going.
Nice. You going to read issue number two?
I will.
Sweet. Yeah. Let's read it together over the phone.
Okay, turn the page.
Wash your hands. Turn the page, then you wash your hands. Do you know what that's from?
No. Nope.
It's from Rocco's Modern Life. His friend, the turtle, who's a comic book nerd. It was an episode where he's like, turn the page, wash your hands, because you got to make sure the comic's 100% mint. No oil on the pages.
Yeah. And Rob Liefeld's going to charge you out the ass for those gradings anyway, so you might as well.
Did you get any oil on your number one pick of the week?
I did not. Good. I was very careful. Nice. My number one pick of the week was Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 5, written by Tom Taylor, with art by Yildire Sinrar. This is a great issue. I really liked how Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number... I really liked how Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man started. I liked the premise of it. And then I thought it got a little too big, given that the selling point was that it was going to be about, this is Peter Parker's block. This is where Spider-Man stays. This is the people he knows. This is his hot dog guy. This is his roommate, kind of born out of Nick Spencer's Amazing Spider-Man with Boomerang living with him right now. These are his neighbors. These are the homeless folks that live on the corner. This is the local police officer that walks this beat, et cetera, et cetera. And then it kind of turned into this slightly too big, here's a giant underground city that is threatening everything that they know and Kingpin is involved and all this stuff. And it was like, whoa, what? That's too much for me. But Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 5 brings it back down to the day-by-day beats of Peter's heroic but also personal life in a way that I was expecting out of this book, and in a way that Tom Taylor, I think, is very, very good at. in exploring the personal toll that heroics take on a internal level. I actually thought that this issue did a better job of that than Symbiote Spider-Man number one, which also came out this week, did. There's a story here that's been told before, but it's very serious and it's very impactful, and it's that Aunt May has cancer. That was revealed Spoilers. In a backup story. Well, it was a backup story to Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number one. Yeah. But they haven't really touched on it in like four issues, aside from the fact that May was calling Pete and he wasn't around to answer. This issue is all about that. And it's really, really well done in that she explains what's happening, and she says, "I want you to be there for me." And he says, "I can't. I'm busy. I have things to do." And I was like, Peter Parker, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Be there for your aunt. And then he goes to say, "I know, not to her aloud, but in the narration, I know gods and I know magicians and I know devils and I know technical marvels like Iron Man and stuff. And I've seen them get super strong and I've seen them fall, but I didn't know until I saw Aunt May be vulnerable that I thought she was the strongest person I ever knew."
Are you weeping, audience?
That's exactly the kind of thing that I think happens to people who have a family member that gets really sick. And they have to deal with the fact that these people that are larger than life to them, that mean so much to them, and that have done so much for them, have vulnerabilities. And that you often have to step up into their role that they've been filling for you for so long, to take care of them. And Peter is that for the world at large, but Aunt May is that for him. And to switch the power structure in that way is so, so well done. And Peter is initially angry. He accidentally breaks a kid's arm trying to stop a car robbery. Very Symbiote Spider-Man. Very aggressive and emotionally raw and stuff. And then he kind of reconciles and realizes that he needs to take care of May. But it was emotionally raw. It was emotionally resonant. It was still funny, I thought. Doctor Strange has a little bit about Peter asking him to communicate magically with a normal spider.
Nice.
And a talking ghost dog and all this stuff. And it still feels like Spider-Man, but it also feels like Peter Parker. And that's exactly what I wanted out of this comic, and it's exactly what I wanted out of Tom Taylor writing a Spider-Man comic.
At the end, it says the end. Is it? It's not over for Tom Taylor, though, is it?
It's not over. I'm hoping that that is the end of the Aunt May storyline, though,
right.
Because certainly this storyline has been done before,
mm-hmm.
of Aunt May dying or being sick. And I had some hesitancies about that. I really, really think that they nailed the execution on this. And I hope that they don't like continually revisit it or anything like that.
You know, today I found out my girlfriend Lisa, she has an Aunt May. And then I said immediately, of course, "Are you Spider-Man?" And she said, "Maybe." I was like, "Oh, geez."
Jessica Drew?
Boston Spider-Woman. Doesn't have enough skyscrapers to have a Spider-Man, unfortunately.
He's got some pretty good mobility off trees.
That's
and
true.
Taxis and
That's
stuff.
True. We've even seen that.
I played that game.
That's true.
My PS4 got real hot playing that game.
So good.
Yes.
You know what else is?
What is your number one?
You know,
pick?
What else is also so really good. My number one pick. Star Wars: Age of Rebellion, Grand Moff Tarkin by Greg Pak and art by Mark Lamming. Greg Pak this week did a double dose of Star Wars with the Princess Leia book that Forrest has already talked about, and this one, Grand Moff Tarkin number one. This was my number one pick. I just thought it was so well written. First of all, just heads up, I have never read a Tarkin novel. And I know that the Tarkin novel apparently does some of what he did here, which is give you a flashback to when he was a kid and how awful his parentage was, forcing him to hunt. And they didn't care about his well-being because life is hard, so deal with it. Sort of what his childhood was like. So then this book shows that, but then shows us how that has made him who he is and how he's hard-edged while he's trying to ensure that the Death Star is functioning appropriately. The issue takes place, not counting the flashbacks, it takes place, I believe, right after Rogue One and during New Hope, and then maybe a little later, too. It kind of jumps a little bit, because we see a scene where they just or recently blew up the city. What is the city in Rogue One that they blew up? The Jedi city?
Scarif. Oh, well, he mentions blowing up Scarif. Yeah. And then they show Alderaan as well.
Right, and then they blow up Alderaan. Yeah. So anyway, what's the coolest part of this book to me was that he daydreams in a sense. He's talking to his cadets who man all the operations of the Death Star, and they failed. Something went wrong. Apparently, like you need like 100 men to do exactly the right thing at the exact right time for the Death Star to be functioning correctly, and they didn't pull it off. And there's a moment where he's in front of them, and we see him pull his shirt open and fight this dude with like a blade.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
And he's fucking ripped.
He's ripped. He looks like 20. His body does anyway. Although he is very scarred. And he just kills this dude. Like, he doesn't kill him, but he beats the crap out of him. And then we find out it was a daydream that, spoilers, that it was all in his head. It was what he wanted to do to teach the kid a lesson. Because that's kind of how he would have been taught the lesson by his parents. Or whoever that person was in the beginning. I forget if it was his dad or if it was like a grandfather. Anyway, it's just interesting because this character in the movie is so buttoned up and seems like an old dude who's clearly evil. He's clearly dark and goes by the book. But deep down, he's actually like a primal animal. This guy is capable of like hunting you with a knife in his teeth and ripping your gut open, you know? And I never would have thought that from this character. If anything, I would have always thought, based on how he was depicted in A New Hope and Rogue One. Not Rogue One. Yeah, Rogue One. He's in Rogue One, yeah.
Yeah.
How he's depicted there, it's like he's just a leader that would tell someone to go kill that guy. When in fact, we find out from this book, no, if he had the opportunity to hunt a guy down in, say, the Star Destroyer and no one knew about it, he'd do it. But because of, you know, regulations and rules, he can't do that. So, I don't know. I feel like it did a really good job of telling us more about this character and kind of opening up my imagination for who he is.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked it a lot too. And the only reason I didn't pick it is because you did.
Oh, there you go.
I felt like in the same way that nothing is taken away by explaining how Leia got the Bosch costume and how she got to Jabba's palace. Nothing is taken away by explaining how Tarkin keeps the Death Star regimented.
Right.
If anything, you have slightly more, if not a lot more appreciation for the movies,
mm-hmm,
and the characters when you see them.
Yep. And I've read out
it just enriches that characterization.
And just to bounce off what you just said, like a lot of these one shots, they're great for like anyone who wants to experience the character a little bit more, like the Padme book or whatever. There's been a lot, but these feel like they're actually adding something to the canon, whereas a lot, mm-hmm, of these other one shots were just like, hey, want to hang out with Padme or what was the comic you were referring to earlier before this?
I read the Grievous one. I felt like that didn't
want to hang out with Grievous for 20 pages.
Yeah,
read this.
Yeah, and I didn't feel that Padme or Grievous added as much as either of these.
Right.
Yeah.
Anywho, so those are our favorite books of the week. I recommend going picking them up at your local comic book shop because
yes, not from eBay.
No, because vote with your wallet, folks. Moving on, in our next segment, which we haven't had in a while, trending now. What is trending in comic book dumb? Comic book dumb, that's a word, right?
It is now.
So there's a problem going on at a specific publisher. We won't name names, DC Comics. And it seems like...
DC Comics!
You know, I just straight up, I'm going to be 100% clear. I know a lot of the folks that work there in the PR department. I've hung out with them and talked to them at specifically San Diego Comic-Con. They're great people. This isn't a condemnation of them, but it's something's up at DC Comics. And there was a story, I think, from Bleeding Cool a couple months ago, maybe 2 months ago, about, whoa, something's going on. Oh, yeah, that's right. Dan Didio and Jim Lee, there was talk that they might be fired, that books would be canceled. And Dan Didio came out and said, no, that's not the case. Well, the problem is a lot of books like Doomsday Clock keep getting delays, and it makes you wonder what's going on. Like, what is going on with the editors there? What's going on with the creators? Why aren't they pumping out these books in a timely manner like they said they would. And that includes Batman Damned number 3, which was pushed back 2 weeks. Doomsday Clock number 10, pushed back 2 months. I was at San Diego Comic-Con 2 years ago, and they were hyping Doomsday Clock, saying it was going to be a 12-issue series, and 12 issues from now, all of DC would be changed. It's in canon. It's going to happen. Well, we're now going on 2 years since that, and it was only 12 issues. So what? This is not good for storytelling. Obviously, this is going to affect other comic series. If Doomsday Clock was supposed to end and affect all the whole line, and yet we're still 3 issues away from finishing it, what does that mean for the organization as a whole? What does it mean for the stories as a whole? Now, Batman Damned, that's a Black Label book, so it doesn't necessarily affect other books, but people's anticipation, people's interest in the book's going to wane if it doesn't come out on time. So it seems like there's a prevalent trending issue with DC where it's a certain books just aren't coming out, and I want to know why, damn it.
Yeah, I, very succinctly said, I don't know that I have much more to add other than it's the worst possible look for Black Label.
Yeah.
Because it is supposed to be, it's something that is just starting. It is supposed to be the title book. It's supposed to be the lead book for Black Label. Aside from Sean Gordon Murphy's White Knight, which was already completed when they put it in trade and released it for Black Label.
Right. It's like an add-on.
This is the opening salvo, right?
Oh, just to add to that, they are re-releasing Watchmen as a Black Label book, too.
Oh, interesting.
And there's some other older books.
Again, though, that's something that's already
exactly
done.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to like make it a thing before it's actually proven itself.
Right. And I think that they're kind of realizing that they need to retool the ongoings or the, even if they're not ongoing, the directive for Black Label. And rather than being open about that, they're just kind of like pushing it back and pushing it back and pushing it back and not telling retailers or news outlets or anyone why. And that's such a bad look for something that you're trying to get off the ground. Because the conversation doesn't become, isn't it great that we have White Knight and Watchmen and all these other stories that we can own and say, DC has been the home of mature superhero stories for a long time. Mm. It has become, man, they really can't get Damned together. Are they just canceling Black Label?
They really should have had 2 books start the line. That way, if one gets delayed, at least at least they have some Black Label books on the shelf. Doomsday Clock is particularly fascinating to me because Geoff Johns has not said a peep about it. And Gary Frank has. He's gone on Twitter and explains or tried to explain what's going on a little bit, obviously in a short tweet. But Geoff Johns is silent. And I know it's probably because he's too busy directing shows for DC Universe. But so much was put into the hype of this. I was invited to a private cruise boat thing and got to talk to him 2 years ago, and it was like, I remember then, I was like, how much did they spend on this? And it was only like 30 reporters in the boat. Like, this was a huge deal for DC, and it feels like because of all the delays, it's just become less and less important and less interesting.
Yeah, both of them feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so sad.
It's really unfortunate.
I'm so sad.
It's entirely unfortunate, too, because when you look at the Black Label schedule, the stories from Scott Snyder or from Frank Miller and stuff that are scheduled, you can't help but feel the same way we were talking about with War of the Realms and Acts of Evil and Absolute Carnage, all of which I'm still excited about, that everything is held up because they're beholden to something.
Right.
Being done. But unlike Marvel, who can get their stories out on time, they have a problem with swapping out artists. But they often get their books out on time. DC just pushes everything down the calendar. Mm-hmm. And it more negatively impacts my view of the coming stories than Marvel.
You know, last year at San Diego Comic-Con, at the Geoff Johns panel, he talked about further DC Black Label series he's going to be doing. But by the time we get to San Diego Comic-Con this year in July, he probably won't even have Doomsday Clock finished yet. So it's like, what? What are we doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm depressed now, but let's move on to top books for next week, which will make me happier.
That'll cheer
Woo-hoo!
You up.
Woo!
Yeah.
You know what? There's nothing better. You finish all your books for the week. It's Saturday, Sunday, whatever. Whenever you finish reading all your pull list, and you go, wait a minute, let me pull up a list. What's coming out next week that's got me excited? And then all of a sudden, the segment cuts back. Your story, there's new stories to be anticipating, and I just can't wait to know. What is the most anticipated book from you, Forrest?
My most anticipated book for next week is Bloodborne number 11, written by Alice Cott, with art by Brad Simpson and Peter Kowalski. We haven't talked about Bloodborne before. We actually haven't talked about the Dark Souls comics either. Mm-mm. And actually, in general, I would say, aside from Star Wars, we don't talk about franchise comics very much.
No.
There's an argument to be made that Spider-Man and Batman and all that stuff are franchise comics at this point, but not so in the way that I think something like Bloodborne is. And I think the reason is that they're often not very good.
Mm. Right.
They're too wound up in the world, the movie, the show, the game, whatever that they're spinning out of. They're oftentimes just a beat-by-beat retelling, or they don't get the character, they don't get the world, they don't add something. Bloodborne does. Alice Cott's Bloodborne absolutely understands Bloodborne. It absolutely understands the world. It absolutely understands the aesthetics, and it absolutely, absolutely, absolutely understands the bare essentials of what makes the characters in games like Bloodborne and Dark Souls interesting. There is not very much given to you in games like Bloodborne and Dark Souls and even Sekiro, but what there is so rich and engaging and lore-heavy and big, right? It's mostly conceptual. And Cott is also a very large, theoretical, philosophical, conceptual writer who does a really great job of latching onto those ideas, often explained in thin lines of dialogue or item descriptions in the case of these games, and turning them into things that feel like the characters understand them, maybe not in the same way that the player character does in the games. And without a player character around, it makes a lot more sense. And so this current arc is focusing on Eileen the Crow, my favorite character from Bloodborne, and her search for kind of a cure to the blood curse that goes around Bloodborne. I really love it. It's great. And in the same way that the Star Wars comics work, it doesn't take away from anything that you experience in Bloodborne. It lives in that world, and it feels right, and it feels not like a warm hug, like a cold, slimy, Lovecraftian hug. And that's in part because Brad Simpson and Peter Kowalski totally get what Bloodborne should look and feel like. And oftentimes I kind of forget that Bloodborne is coming out. And then I remember, especially when I need to do these weekly top book picks. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good comic. Even just that idea excites me. So, yeah.
With a lot of these licensed books, I always wonder, did it cost such a fortune to acquire the ability to write a comic book about it that possibly their budget for the writer and artist, not to defame any writer or artist who's ever done these, but possibly they could get someone who's a higher tiered writer or artist if it didn't cost so much to buy the license, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like I do.
That's totally
Dynamite
possible.
Had that John Wick comic Greg Pak was writing. That's a pretty top tier writer, but then the book was just delayed to death and it never really came out.
Yeah. And Dynamite has a fantastic James Bond comic.
They do. Yes, they have a couple.
Yep. There's a couple houses that they're pretty good at this.
But yes, that's true.
Oftentimes I feel like the individual franchises will disappoint more so than Bloodborne.
I never played the game, but everyone tells me I should. But then they also talk about how it's torture to play the game. So I'm like, why would I want to be miserable?
Cott actually does a great job of embedding the parts of the game that make it miserable to play into the comic as well.
Oh, that's cool. Really, that's like really that. Cool.
Yeah, they do. In the first issue, there's an all black page with red text that says you die.
Nice. Something that people have seen hundreds of times.
Right.
Well, my top pick for next week is Star Wars TIE Fighter number 1 by Jody Hauser and Roge Antonio. This is very fascinating to me because it's a series that is tying in with a novel called Star Wars Alphabet Squadron. And this novel, and I'm assuming the comic as well, takes place after Return of the Jedi. Okay, so that's really important because by my knowledge, Marvel Comics has not done an in-canon comic yet that takes place in this time frame. Everything has been between Empire and New Hope, except say for the Leia book that came out this week, which is right after Empire and before Return of the Jedi. They've also done prequel comics, but that was only recently, and those weren't really adding much to canon. They were just more like explorations of characters. But this is possibly going to give us something new post Return of the Jedi, which is really exciting, since most of their big canon changing books have taken place in only one time frame. This allows them to potentially explore even more. And I'm wondering, because there's a novel that's already been approved and coming out that takes place around the same time as this comic series, maybe they were given the okay to go ahead and play around in that part of the universe, because maybe the Star Wars story group, which approves all stories, were like, yeah, you're fine. Jody Hauser's writing this, who has done phenomenal work across the board with these Star Wars stories.
She's awesome.
She does a lot of adaptations too. She did Stranger Things too. I actually spoke to her the last year at San Diego Comic Con. She's really cool in person as well. And so I'm just really excited about this too, because TIE fighters, right? Like when we watch these movies, there's hundreds of them die per second at some points. And maybe they all have personalities, you know, maybe. And Finn has obviously helped us understand that they are people too. But we need further exploration, I think, of these characters, because pretty much they've been cannon fodder up until this point. So I'm really excited to see how they flesh out that, not only those characters, but also that kind of job that they have as basically one of thousands of guys or girls in a spaceship that's probably going to get blown up 150 times per X-Wing.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I'm very excited for it too. Especially coming hot off of the books this week and also those trailers, y'all.
As Star Wars Celebration is wrapping up today, Sunday, and a lot of crazy news has come out, folks. Go to AIPTcomics.com to check that out. You know what we're going to talk about now, right?
How I'm still standing. Do you want to stand check in?
Yeah, how many waves have you done since?
Just the one.
Okay.
It did look like the worm, and I felt weird about it. My left knee is now resting on a chair nearby.
Okay.
Folks, this is hard. Uh-huh. Do people do this all day for their work?
We are an hour and five into this.
This is tough.
Soon you're going to get quieter and quieter because you're just going to sit on the floor.
There's just going to be a groan coming from the floor up to the mic.
I'm so tired. Next up, guys, Judging by the Cover Junior, where we talk about our favorite comic book cover art. This is the part of a comic that sells it to a large majority of folks, because they're not like us. We're not reading solicits months in advance and reading stories necessarily every week, keeping up, watching everything that writers and artists do on Twitter, possibly going outside their house looking through windows. Who knows? There's levels of intensity. And long story short, these are the covers that we think sell books so well because it's so goddamn gorgeous. Forrest, what is your favorite comic book cover art of the week?
My favorite comic book cover art of the week is Spider-Man Life Story number 2. I guess subtitled The 70s.
Mm.
This is cover art and also written by Chip Zdarsky. This is the continuation of the Life Story series. The first cover art for that was also fantastic. The turquoise blue Spider-Man hanging off of the helicopter one. That was the 60s. This is the 70s. It's bright orange, Halloween orange. Spider-Man is hanging onto a disco ball that has the Green Goblin iconographic eyes and mouth carved into it. It's all larger than life. It feels very heroic, and it feels very...
disco?
Simple. Yeah. Not disco, actually. It feels very simple. It feels very tailor-made and...
Taylor Swift?
Bespoke. It feels bespoke.
Okay.
It feels like it was very specifically made for this story and only this story alone, in that it highlights the specific things, the specific... This is tough. Chip Zdarsky, you did a good one. you done a good one for a funny man.
The color choice is amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It highlights the specific motifs of the decade in a very good way, in a very essential, straightforward way, in the same way that a lot of these covers do. I'm very excited about this series. I think it's very good. And A Disco Ball is perfect for the 70s. In the same way that Spider-Man and the Green Goblin are also perfect for the story. And to do so simply and also make it feel brand new and fresh and simple and also reverent to the stories that Spider-Man was being told, that Spider-Man stories that were being told in the 70s were, feels really good. I like it a lot. And I think this whole line of covers is poster worthy. This one, chief amongst them. It's actually my favorite, the ones we've seen so far.
Essentially, it's just two colors, right? Because black is a shade, right?
Oh, let's not get into it. Yeah.
You know, I love Halloween, so I was instantly in, you know, I just loved it. And then I was like, oh, wait, it's a disco ball. Oh, that's cool, too. It's a pretty sweet cover. You know what I liked, though? Yeah. Do you want to know what I liked?
I want to know.
Barbarella / Deja Thoris number 3 by Julius Ota. This is a book that has like 50 variant covers. Not really. More like 6. That's a lot.
Yeah, they do a lot. They do a lot of those.
So there's a lot to pick and choose from. This one is hyper-realistic, I'd say. It's very good with lighting and anatomy. And by anatomy, I mean two women practically naked on the cover. obviously, there's some sexploitation here. But I feel like, given the fact that it's who it's written by, Leah Thompson, and the fact that it's both two sex positive characters, I don't feel like it's exploitive, but I don't know why, because Deja basically has a little piece of cloth covering her pubis area and two stickies on her nipples, whereas Barbarella is in a skin tight red and yellow pleather costume. Regardless, the anatomy is spot on, and I like how there's a subtle alien world vibe going on. They're standing on these like roots that are clearly have some, like, they're pink for starters, and they've got some sort of moss growing off them, and in the background there's like this yellow smoke. They're clearly in like some kind of swamp realm. Meanwhile, though, they're like holding hands, like, yeah, we rule, we're together in this. And yeah, they're just, I don't know, it's very like, I don't know, confident, the cover. And I just really, I don't know, it's really well done. And actually, I did Judging by the Cover this week with Eric Klein. And this is in my my top 3.
Available every Monday over at AIPTComics.com.
Hell yeah! All right, guys, those are our favorite covers. See them at the actual post of this this podcast, at AIPTComics.com. You'll see it, like, if you scroll down a little bit.
Blogcast!
So we are at the end, which, well, not quite, but we're almost at the end. And this is the soapbox part of our show.
Yeah.
And take it away, Forrest.
All right, so I got to own up to something. Uh-oh. The reason that I stumbled on that Spider-Man Live story description there was because I saw this coming.
Uh-oh.
And I got mad. I got mad online just thinking about this. I titled this soapbox WWSMD, which, if you're familiar with the phrase, what would Jesus do? This one is, what would Spider-Man do? Last week, I chose Symbiote Spider-Man number 1, written by Peter David, as the comic I was most excited for. And then I saw a writer, I won't name him, on Twitter point out, it's pretty interesting that guy landed a Spider-Man book considering the things he said about Roma people at Comic-Con. And I was like, well, there's only one new Spider-Man book coming out this week. I know a lot about Nick Spencer. I know he's not popular, but I don't think he's ever said anything against Roma people. I know Tom Taylor hasn't. So I can reverse engineer this. It's Peter David. So I looked it up, and at NYCC 2016, Peter David made some absolutely grotesque statements about Roma people, often colloquially referred to as gypsies, which is a slur. It's not something you should say. You should also not say the phrase gypped. By the way, it's very offensive.
I bring that up to people all the time.
Those terms were used against them to further marginalize those communities. And Peter David told a story about how he was in Europe and he saw some Roma families asking for money, and he really villainized them. And then someone else said, well, that's not what all Roma families do. And he said, no, it is. I know them, and other kinds of stuff. He has since apologized for that. But it's absolutely wild to me on two fronts. One, that someone that has written Captain America, Spider-Man, Thor, Doctor Strange, any of those characters would ever, ever, ever say something like that. And two, that Marvel would give that person a job writing those characters. What would Spider-Man do? Spider-Man would not say something about the Roma people. He would not make generalizations about the Roma people. He would not call them gypsies. He would not say that they gypped someone out of something. Those are slurs. He would not do that. Peter David. It's gross.
Yeah, your emphatic Peter David made me laugh. Sorry.
No. The ridiculousness of it is almost hilarious to me.
He did say he was sorry, though. Should we?
Sure.
Should we accept his apology and move on?
I think that people can grow, and I think that people can change. I'm willing to accept that. And I think that that's an important part of the human condition. I don't know that I think that Marvel should have given him a job writing these heroic characters who set standards for children, given what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And given how emphatic and serious he was.
He was pretty off that chain on that. Like, seemed like something was wrong with him mentally. Like, not that there was, but it just... People don't normally fly off the handle like he did. It was odd how passionate he was. I remember talking to people who were actually on the floor from AIPT there, and like, it was just bizarre. Like, what was going on with him? It was strange.
And I think that people say the same thing about artist Salvador La Roca, saying that the colorist on Uncanny X-Men is a woman. He pointed that out when he posted the black and white inks of his art. He said,
Rachel Rosenberg, I think it was.
Yes. He said, my inks are really good, but I don't like the colors. A woman in this case. And people might say, oh, that's so random. It's not random. That's how bigots think. That's how bigots are. They weaponize their hatred of other people.
Not to mention, they say these things not realizing how offensive it is, because in their mind, it isn't.
In their mind, it is not.
Right.
In Peter David's mind at the time, every Roma family across Europe was like that. That is not indicative of the character that Spider-Man is, and it is not indicative of the kind of person that I want writing a Spider-Man story. Furthermore, there's a lot of talk, and I bring it up all the time, that the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, C.B. Zabolski, is courting John Byrne to bring him back for the kind of nostalgia story, Rob Liefeld, Eric Larson, those kinds of things that they've been doing. I have no problem with Rob Liefeld and Eric Larson. We goofed on Liefeld at the beginning of this a lot. I don't have a problem with him. In a forum post, In the last decade, I couldn't put a specific date on it because I have not revisited it after I read it, John Byrne compared trans people to pedophiles. Full stop. He said, I think that they both have mental illnesses that should be treated. That's not the kind of person I ever want to come back to Marvel Comics. It's not the kind of person I ever want to see drawing, writing Captain America, Black Panther, X-Men, any of those characters, because it's not indicative of what those characters are, and it's not indicative of the stories that should be told in a medium that was conceived and is still primarily for children. It's gross. Anyways. it pisses me off.
No, yeah. Yeah, you make good points. And, you know, if this company stands for something, knowing full well what these people have said in the past or done in the past, that's a statement in itself, right?
Absolutely. And it's not a statement that I support.
Right.
And it's not a statement as we as people in the media should support. And I don't think it's a statement we as fans should support. It's hard.
You gotta vote with your wallet.
I get it. I also like Spider-Man. Last week I talked about how excited I was for Symbiote Spider-Man before I knew that about Peter David.
Oh, you didn't know?
I did not know that.
Oh, okay.
And it immediately soured that book for me.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately. I think that it is possible in some instances to divorce the artists from the things that they have said.
Mm.
But I think that it is Marvel's responsibility to put people into positions where they are voicing a message that Marvel agrees with. And I don't think that they're very good at that right now. I'm not saying that they should be censored.
Well, they haven't.
I'm not saying they should fire Chuck Wendig. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Oh, yeah. Chuck Wendig, yeah. Well, they haven't hired Byrne yet. So
they have not.
We can't yell at them for that necessarily.
No. That's true. But they did rehire Peter David.
Right. I wonder if they rehired him before he apologized or after. I don't know how it happened, how it played out. I do know there was a good month where people were really upset with Peter David, and then it kind of died off.
Yeah. Well, the Twitter hate machine keeps on rolling, right?
And they
we're mad about something every week.
Yeah. Economy of complaint.
I get it.
A lot of those things.
I get mad about stuff too.
There are things that people probably shouldn't get mad about, but they still do.
Yeah, and there's a scale. There's a sliding scale for this stuff, and I totally get that. I'm not saying that artists should be totally censored. I'm not saying that people should have their lives destroyed or that you should dox people and send hateful notes or show up on their doorsteps or whatever because they said things. Unless they're emphatic, unavowed Nazis or whatever. I'm glad Richard Spencer got punched in the face. That's another issue. But maybe don't let him write Spider-Man, because what would Spider-Man do? That's what I'm saying.
Well, you're so worked up, and it's upsetting what you said. It really is. Is there, if we were to have an off-topic, top-shelf pick from you that was happy-making and positive, what would it be and why?
Let me calm down a little bit. Oh, I could calm down with this. So there is a really great series on YouTube called It's Alive.
Ooh.
And It's Alive is a cooking series, or actually rather a fermentation series. The host is Brad Leone. He is the test kitchen manager for Bon Appetit magazine and website. And every week, it used to be around every week, but now it's kind of like monthly or even bi-monthly. He does a web series where he shows people how to make kimchi or pickles or garlic honey, any sort of thing that requires fermentation, miso, all sorts of different stuff. He has fun guests on. He goes places and learns how they make olive oil and knives and all sorts of stuff that they use in the test kitchen. I really like it a lot, and it's really endearing. It's really well edited. It's really well done. It's informational. It kind of dissuades you from being wary about fermentation and about pickles and vinegar and stuff, which I think a lot of people are kind of grossed out by or hung up on.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be at all. That stuff is totally safe as long as you do it right. I've made pickles myself, and they're fantastic. They're way, 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 way better than picking them up in the store. But the most fun about it is that this dude has, like, the most ridiculous New Jersey accent in the world, and he can't turn it off. And the guy that films it and edits it is named Vinny. So Brad, the host, will be going, okay, so now you get your cup of water. And Vinny will put a screen up that says water, W-O-U-R-D-E-R.
Nice.
And so there's all this really fun, like, playful stuff. And there's one time where Brad, he's got smoke in his eyes, and he's like, oh, my eyes hurt. That's called suffrage. And Vinny puts the description of suffrage, the right to vote, up under Brad's eyes. It's really, really nice. Great. It's really fun, and it's super informative.
Awesome. I have to check that out. And it's free because it's on YouTube.
And it will inspire you to make pickles.
Nice.
Which you should do. You should drop
Lisa's
out.
Done a lot of canning. One time we were going to do olive oils for Christmas, although that's not fermentation. That's just canning, I guess.
Fermentation's really fun. It can be really fast, and it's really open to a lot of experimentation. And I think they're really great at showcasing that. Yeah.
You know what also is really fast? Our goodbyes. Thank you so much for listening to the show. That's it. That's the end. Thank you for subscribing. You know what? You should subscribe, though. Definitely subscribe and like. And you know what? If you want to keep listening, we won't stop you.
I wouldn't stop you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.